So before we maybe get into the weeds of fundraising, should we maybe set a few things up by like understanding why do people fundraise? Like, why do people raise money?
So the whole idea of a startup, and that is what right this entire conversation is about having the ability to execute, implement, and grow and scale an idea very fast. Right. What that means is there will be some sort of burn. You prioritize growth over profitability most of the times, and that is the right way to do, provided it is done in a sane, rational manner in the right sort of market. If the product has product market fit, you would need capital to be able to deploy into growth. That's the whole point. Otherwise, it's a lifestyle business where you are selling a product or services. You are making a certain profit, which enables you to sustain the business at a certain pace, at a certain level, good for your lifestyle, or rather maintaining the team, maintaining the business at a steady state. But you don't expect to build an Amazon or a Flipkart or for that matter, a Freshworks out of this kind of approach, however logical that might be. See, and that is what separates out a startup, in my sense, from a traditional, conventional, small scale business. You have a product or a service or an idea which is game changing. You need to scale it before others can, because ideas are no one's monopoly, right? The whole play is about executing and implementing the idea in the best possible manner and reach at a certain scale and size where you become the category leading product or service. That's what the entire startup story is all about, and that is what we have been witnessing in India over past few years.
So the ability to grow and to deploy funds to make that growth happen is like maybe one of the reasons why people might raise venture funds, etc.
That's right.
So when, at least when I think about fundraising, and I'm like, I don't know, I feel like my knowledge is like of an average person, not too much knowledge into like fundraising or VC's ecosystem per se. So when I think about like fundraising, generally I get ideas like Series A, Series B. That's what I hear in the news, and B, C, D, and that's what comes to my mind when people talk about fundraising. But I think even before that, are there things that happen before people get to that place of like, Series A, or maybe even before seed? Are there things that people look to raise? Where does this kind of process of fundraising actually begin?
No, very, very good question. And obviously, there is a lot which happens before you get into a state where an institutional investor would start looking at you, right? Or start taking interest in the idea. Because ultimately, everything would start, the conventional story or the playbook is you would start as a college product or an idea that you have. You deploy your own resources. But for most of the people, these resources are limited, right? You would build the company, you set it up. You would possibly have a co-founder who would be matching that contribution in terms of time, effort, as well as the capital to be contributed. But at some point, there will have to be external capital coming in, which not necessarily is institutional in nature, but helps you take that idea from an idea in your brain to at least a paper stage to develop some concept you would call it as a demo, at least reach there. And typically these would be your friends, your families, and your early backers, college seniors, college professors, your own network, right? Who would believe you, and most important point here, Ryan, is the ability to convince people that you're onto something. You want to make a sincere effort and this idea is genuine and you want to put your skin in the game, and this is pure conviction. There is nothing else, right? That is when people, even your own family members, right, would be supporting you because they believe in you. That is the most important part. And this never goes away, by the way, whether you're raising the friends and family round or you're raising an IPO, people have to believe in you. And that story has to be credible at each point in time. So typically you would start with your proof of concept, which would be backed by, you know, your personal network. Typically, it could also be an accelerator. So for example, IIT Chennai has a great accelerator. Government of India has an accelerator program, and there are many others who support ideas at a, you know, at a pen and paper stage, if I were to say. And accelerators are also not only about funding, but also about a lot of knowledge, support, an ecosystem that can help you conceptualize, build, at least to the demo, right, or proof of concept stage. So these would be few sources which would be early when you are still thinking about your idea. And once you have a working proof of that concept, you would possibly be able to tap into the angel ecosystem, which again would be an extended part of your personal network, right? But again, and again, these will be people who like the technology, who like to support the early stage ecosystem that is being built, who like to work, interact, support young founders, or any founders for that matter, right? And that is, angel money is also like, it is about money, because now you need to build a working proof of your work. You need to get that, you know, the business kick started. At the same time, angel money is also about a lot of handholding, typically, because many angels want to be value added, right? And their motivation in backing you, A, financial, that is, which is all good, like, every human being is a rational being and everyone has a financial motive. At the same time, a lot of this motivation is also, I would say, also about working very closely and guiding and mentoring people.
So if I can push back on that idea, I'm not very convinced with that. So I'll tell you where I'm coming from. So when I hear people like, so I've heard that Kunal Shah or some of these successful entrepreneurs who have a lot of money per se, who have that they want to deploy in startups. So generally, the way I'm thinking about this is, if they invest in, let's say, startups, and I'm also thinking about, let's say, Anupam Mittal, who has invested in, let's say, 200 companies per se. So when these people invest in so many companies, it becomes very difficult for them to keep an update on day-to-day events of that company, or even maybe help them. So could you maybe paint... there I'm finding it difficult to bridge that gap where when they are running a business by themselves, like how can they allocate so much time to maybe help these people as well? So there I'm a little not convinced there.
No, typically, Ryan, all angels would have, you know, some business or some, you know, position which would need their time and effort, right? These are accomplished people, academics, industrialists, right? People in the startup ecosystem. You took some names, all of them. They're investing out of their personal interest in the startup. The bandwidth that they can allocate and the motivations might vary person to person, right? But at the same time, you are getting into the right kind of networks, and the ability to leverage those networks or make that angel investment, you know, work for you beyond the money. And the same argument, by the way, can also be taken about, you know, let us say venture capital firms or early growth firms, right? Each investor would have a different style and a different way of contributing to the journey. So for example, we at Bloom believe a lot in handholding and supporting our portfolio companies. Others might not. And no approach is better than other. I mean, you can argue on both sides of the equation. So I don't think there is a dichotomy there. It is just about how engaged people are and how much they and what ways they want to contribute. So, for example, a few of the names that you took bring phenomenal networks. They might not be very hands-on, but the network can do wonders, provided you can make it work. So it would work in multiple ways. We won't know for sure, but obviously there is a lot of value which angels would bring to the table as well, at least when the company is young.
So I feel when you're trying to convince your friends and family or your first extended network or your your initial network per se, the ability of sales, I think, is very pivotal. No? I think it's a very key trait without which nothing can get started. Like if you're not able to, even if you're, I feel like even if your idea might be very good or you might have like a breakthrough thought per se, but if you're not able to sell that really well, you kind of get stuck in that idea phase itself, right?
That's right. And that applies at all stages, right? The founder has to be able to sell himself and the business. At each stage, I mean, this will get repeated with more intensity, right? Right from, as you mentioned, even selling to our friends, we'll need to convince them. We'll need to sell them. Similarly, when you're talking to a, let us say, a venture capital firm or a private equity firm or IPO investor, it would involve that selling at each point in time. And the founder will need to scale that element as they grow into their journey. And there is no harm if one founder is, I would say more oriented towards only doing tech. There are, you can always find complementary skills, onboard co-founders or key people in the team who would help you reach there. But at some level, the founder, it is upon the founder to be able to do that.
So even if a person is like not very, you know, there are some people who do not like to socialize much or may not like to quote unquote sell, right? So even for them, it is very important that, you know, they come out of that box and really start to develop the skill per se.
Yes, definitely. And it is not about changing your personality. It is just about putting the, the business and yourself in the right perspective. To be able to connect authentically with people, to reach out to the right people, to leverage your networks, and to be able to, sell that story. You don't need to be an extrovert to do that. You could be an introvert. We have seen multiple examples in our portfolio of these kind of founders who have successfully raised funds till growth stage. At the same time, they are not extroverts.
Fair enough. Network and relationship are like two words which have come multiple times in this conversation. So I just want to understand, like, maybe at the seed stage, or maybe when you're looking to raise funding, or even before you start looking to raise funding, what do you think can be done? Like, what kind of things can a person do to start maybe building that relationship, even if I'm not looking to raise, but, or maybe I have a thought in mind that maybe a year down the line I might raise, or maybe in 3 months I might raise. So what do you suggest? Like, how can people effectively either build relationships, or is it even important to do that?
I feel it is very important. And there is a very interesting saying which goes as follows, right? If you seek advice, you might get funding. Right, if you seek funding, you will definitely get advice. So on a serious note, you have to reach out to the right set of people who can help you, not only with funding, but also for example, when you are thinking about an idea or a project, right? You can't be doing it into a echo chamber. You need to have feedback. You need to, reach out, do some problem solving with other people if you are hitting roadblocks. All of that is I think it's a very iterative process, which continues. And good founders would always, be excited to talk to other people, to be able to seek help. Because there'll be always some gaps either in the thought process or in the product or some tech problem. It could even be something as arcane as filing a company's return or a tax return for the business, and at early stages you don't have the benefit of a CFO, for example. You will need to figure that out. So all this, I think, to my mind, it's a part of the overall problem solving that a founder has to do throughout the journey, and it is very important to build these kind of networks since inception. And what I also believe, these will build very organically, because obviously you are not building in isolation unless you are doing some scientific research and a product which is very heavy on the tech, not as much on the marketing or the front end. those are outlier situations, but you would definitely need some input, some conversations would happen, and one thing leads typically to another, especially in a country like India, where, you know, you will, there are so many people who are engaging within the ecosystem, made it very vibrant, as we have seen over past few years. So I think it's an iterative process. It's an organic process. And these things would come very naturally to someone who is out there building.
So just a digression. So you believe that the VC ecosystem or the startup ecosystem is like very vibrant, is it? Like very engaging and very enthu, if I may use that word.
It is. And it has evolved in that direction. So if we were to, for example, talk about, let's say, 10 years back, 2013, right? You didn't have as many founders. You didn't have large companies. You didn't have these, you know, good engineers, good marketing professionals, etc., working for many startups, because the ecosystem was quite small. This has been expanding day after day, right? And now you have a pool of people who are within the ecosystem. You have entrepreneurs who have seen cycles, who have exited successfully, who have maybe who have seen failures, all of those. And all of that has added a lot of value to the ecosystem. You have various shades of investors now, right? And even external participants. You have a lot more support in terms of, for example, advisory support, in terms of, you know, the tech backends that we have, things like AWS or Google Cloud, which didn't exist a long time ago. So I would definitely believe that we have a very strong and vibrant ecosystem that is getting built in India.
What problems do you see, though? Do you see any like glaring issues with the system?
See, again, there will be, so for example, all these issues keep on getting talked, especially when the markets turn bad, right? So for example, we have seen a spate of corporate governance issues come to fore. We have in 2021, we saw that talent was at a premium. People were looking to hire, could not get good talent. Things were exorbitant, right? The salaries and the packages that were being asked, the CTs were out of the whack. But as all things in life, right, there is always a normal to be achieved. There'll be ups and downs, and each you know successive trough would lead to a higher apex. That is how it would be. So these problems, like, you know, getting good talent, right, building in the right way, getting the right kind of capital to build in the right way, think about it in the right, you know, in the right direction to build, to be able to build rationally, all those excesses get solved by one downturn. That's my feeling.
Understood. Going back to, like, when you think of a founder role, I mean, at least for me, I feel like it's predominantly, when I think about it, I feel like, you know, it's taking care of the product and, you know, people. But you were mentioning it so much more, you know, you have to figure out, at least early on, maybe, you know, there are so many other things like tax, maybe, or legal compliance. You have to worry about all those things. So it's not only just, you know, you and your product, but there are so many things going on that you have to be on top of multiple things, at least early on, right?
Absolutely. Because, see, a founder has to do everything, at least in the early stages. And that is what gives them the insight to, you know what to build the team around. What are the gaps that they see? And if they are able to visualize how they, I mean, as they go along the journey, what would they want to, you know, invest in terms of the people, in building what kind of functions, and what is, obviously there is a lot of input which comes to them, and they would also learn as they grow along. But being a founder means, you know, having to get yourself involved and learn everything that the business touches, be it compliance, as I said, be it legal, because you are negotiating agreements, so you need to know all of that, finance, marketing, backend, ops, administration, all of that. Nothing is untouched.
Fair enough. I want to ask you maybe two related questions. So one is, like, how to, we discussed the vibrant ecosystem, but one is like how to navigate the space. like when you're looking to raise, like how to go about it. Is it through attending events, or is it through LinkedIn messages, or how would you recommend? And I think slightly related to that, and sorry for bundling it in, is maybe some, you could outline a few steps and strategies also involved in like raising funds. Yeah.
Right. So there is no one size fits all solution here. And I can share, right? So I have been involved in fundraisers for Bloom, right? Because ultimately we are a venture capital firm. We reach out to our investors, seek capital, typically in 3-year cycles. So we undergo a similar journey as our founders do. And of course, different things work for different people. But again, I would still like to use it for the nth time in last, you know, few minutes of a conversation. You would need to reach out to your network. For example, I would go and shamelessly ask our investors, our LPs, to introduce us to others if they like us and they believe in us. That is one way. See, which is why your early investors, your early ecosystem would be very important, because they would be the ones who would be validating you to that next round of fundraise or to the next set of investors. So you have to be out in the market. LinkedIn, of course, some firms have a policy of responding to everyone who approaches them, right? Someone else might have a different way of doing things. All of that happened. One cannot. So it is a very personal thing. You need to figure out what works best for yourself. Right? Be it LinkedIn, writing into people, keep on meeting people. As I said, I mean, even for taking feedback, because typically what we have seen is people are quite generous with their time if the right questions are asked, not generally, right? So there could be multiple touch points. And again, and these references could come from anywhere. So it is no one size fits all, but at the same time, it is very, very dynamic. In the sense that, you know, everyone in the value chain, be it your own investors, be it your, for example, team members, it could be anyone, right? Your school seniors, other founders, even your competitors. I mean, everyone, because honestly, there is no, you know, lock on any capital. So that is how I would think of it. So you need to figure out, and again, the right strategy here, actually, that is the more relevant question. Is, for example, you are a SaaS company, you're building a SaaS product. You need to figure out, I mean, who are the investors who would be interested in these kind of products? Would you seek validation, for example, from a consumer company? I don't think so. Maybe you go out and seek validation from some of your own customers, ask them for references, right? They could potentially try and translate them into, you know, with a small check, because that's a validation. It could be different things. But again, it is you need to have very clear targets and have very relevant conversations with the right set of people. You can't be random. You can't, because see, everyone's time is valuable, including founders. So for example, as a firm, we would not want to waste a founder's time if we have nothing to offer to them. Right, because we know that they are hustling, they are building, you know, 24/7, and we respect that as a firm. Similarly, others would also like, and similarly, we are also obligated to, you know, return the same favor, so as to speak. So very clearly,
please finish your thought, please.
Okay, no. So again, in terms of strategy, cold reach outs, warm introductions. Right, getting people excited and engaged, being out. So events work great for people who want to, you know, meet new people. For some people, they don't work. It depends on how you want to do it. Some people are better off in one-on-one settings. Maybe just rely on warm leads, etc. If need be, take help of a banker. There is no harm, because they bring a lot of value to the table in that sense, especially on the process side. But that is possibly at a later point in time.
I want to take another digression. When you mentioned the, when you mentioned the role of the founder, and you were talking about, how you don't want to waste their time and how they are kind of building 24/7. I feel like that image of the founder, working all the time and, hustling all the time. I feel that's a bit exaggerated in the sense that obviously it's a very important role and they obviously work a lot, but I don't know. I feel that image is kind of glorified where, they're not taking vacations and they're not sleeping and they're just working. Is that fair or what do you think?
Interesting. No, so obviously, see, no one expects anyone to be working 24. So 24/7 is more like a metaphor. A founder might not be, working in office 24/7, but they're living the founder's life, right? If they are not working, let us say, learning new things, they are spending time in expanding the network. So many of these things are not work. But they are work. Right? At the same time, we also need to be cognizant that for most of the founders, right, there is a huge opportunity cost which is involved, right, which motivates them to make the most of the time that they have got into building the startup and scaling it. So while 24/7 could be a much abused metaphor, but fact is that you need to be passionate and deeply involved, and that takes up all your mental space. It is not as much about the physical space or the physical time. It is about the mental space and the kind of treadmill that you are on, always wanting to grow and scale, and build, and firefight across multiple fronts. So that actually is 24/7. It is not a point in time. It's a continuum that you are living. And at each scale, let us say you're moving on from your, let's say, a pre-seed round to a seed round, seed to a Series A founder to a Series B founder. At each point, you have to reinvest time and effort in reinventing yourself, in learning new things and scaling 1 to 10 and 10 to 50 and 50 to 100. Right? Each time the journey is different, the expectations are different, the team is different. Or rather, team is scaling up. Your investors, your stakeholders, everyone has a expectation from you, which a founder needs to factor in and keep on adding to their skills and to their, I would say, arsenal.
I want to continue this thread in the sense that when you mentioned, it takes up a lot of your mental space. And even though you're not working, you're kind of working. So in that sense, do you think it gets difficult to start a company once you have a family?
Honestly, no. Because obviously each person's, I would say, circumstances are different. And you need to have, at the same time, you need to have some sort of financial stability. Without which, starting something or doing something productive or creative doesn't make any sense, right? At the same time, there is a sacrifice involved in terms of the time, the effort, which is disproportionate, and the obviously there would be, the whatever you are earning, even if you are a funded startup, would be much lower than your opportunity cost. So one has to be at a place in life where they are secure financially, or at least stable, if not fully secure financially, to be able to devote their time and attention to, building something. And obviously, when you are creating something, right, there are other people's lives, livelihoods, which depend on you. You are responsible for your team members. So obviously not easy, but at the same time, we haven't seen that to be a impediment. Right, and different people have different ways of dealing with it. Some of them have, for example, have had some windfalls or have had, savings from their previous career. Some of them have family support, right? A spouse has a career which allows them to be able to experiment or rather embark upon this journey. So there are multiple ways, But at the same time, it can't be done without having some sort of financial stability.
Understood. I want to close the loop on sources, but just to make sure that I've understood that. So sources of funding might, like, at the very early stage might include friends and family, and then your extended network again, which is friends. And then there are institutions like yours, maybe. There are VC firms, let's say Bloom, Sequoia, XYZ, ABC, and you can maybe go to them and ask for funding. Then there are banks as well, I think, where you can take a loan and maybe start then work on your project or work on your company. Is there anything else I'm missing out in terms of, like, sources of where you can go for funding, or have we covered the basis there?
No, these are the sources. Obviously, as I said, at very early stages, it would be your friends and families, it could be accelerators, it could be angels. As you grow, right, you go to a pre-seed or a seed stage, you would possibly micro VCs would find you interesting enough and fund your idea, right? As you get into seed to pre-series A, the early stage firms like Bloom, etc., would be the right source of funding for you. And as you grow, again, Sequoia's, Axis, Nexus, or rather P15, right? The later stage or venture stage firms would come in. One point I would want to make here about banks. Now, typically, banks would never fund a early stage business. What would happen typically is there are either venture debt firms or some banks which run venture debt programs, which would be happy to fund. But these typically come at Series A or beyond. They would not. And the best use of that funding is to augment your runway without diluting. So a bank won't be funding burn per se, but they would definitely be happy funding growth. And obviously, that funding has to be leveraged and used in the right way. For example, either for your working capital for a short period of time, you also have to factor, for example, working capital. Venture debt firms would typically have warrant kind of structures built in, which give them, right to equity, either at the previous valuation or at the next valuation. Those kind of things. So banks would not be the right, partner at a very early stage, because they don't have the mechanisms to fund this. They would need collateral. They would need to have visibility on the cash flows. And typically a startup would have none of this. One interesting source, especially if you're working in certain areas, would be grants. So either corporates or various bodies, Government of India would have some programs which would allow some grants. If you are, for example, working, let us say, I'm just taking a hypothetical example, clean technology. There are various bodies which are running programs which have some grants which enable you to, keep on sustaining the business till such time you get a strategic or a financial investor in. Those could be interesting sources.
For early stages, it seems like banks probably may be a no-no. Are there any other sources you think are probably you would stay away from? Is there a case obviously a lot of the questions I may ask you will not have like a right or a wrong answer, and it may be very subjective. In a sense, is there any sources you would stay away from, or do you think are a no-no? I don't know.
See, honestly, I don't think any sources of capital are bad. Just that a founder has to evaluate whether it makes sense and they are the right partners at that point in time for them. For example, if you're a very early stage business and you have a venture firm who finds your idea path breaking and wants to invest in you at that early stage, would, as a business, you would have bandwidth and the resources to be able to meet the investor requirements? Or as you grow, would you want to add a lot of names on the cap table, which would make compliances, processes, etc., slightly long-winded? So it is just that you have to take these calls at different point in time, whether you would, for example, want to onboard a strategic investor at an early stage. right? There is a perception among financial investors that having a strategic investors could not lead to a lot of value unlocking. Right? That's a perception. The reality could be, you know, anything. So it is just that you need to take these decisions at the point of fundraise, factoring in your specific situations. As you said, Ryan, there are no right or wrong answers here, right? You have to evaluate and see, I mean, what sources of capital are available. And again, it has a lot to do with the kind of terms that are being offered. Because the fundraise is not only about valuation, it's a package. And that package includes terms like your anti-dilution, right? Your liquidation preference, all of that. The board rights, all of that needs to be factored in holistically. It can't be just simply a valuation is equal to fundraise kind of equation. It is far more nuanced.
So at this point, should we get into like what happens during a typical raise? Like maybe I'll let you choose. Like, I don't know if you want to, like if I was to raise, let's say a seed or series A, I'll leave that up to you. Like what happens and is that a complicated process?
Okay.
If you could touch on, yeah.
So honestly, it is not a complicated process. Right, you are in the market to raise funds. You have a certain, you know, business which is at a certain stage. Let us take an example of a seed stage company, and at that point you would have a MVP, or you would be close to MVP, a minimum viable product. Right? You need a certain amount of capital to go from, let us say, point A to B. Right, at which point you would have a certain traction in terms of, depending on the nature of the business you are running, either let us say if you are a commerce business, GMV, you would reach a certain GMV or a number of customers or number of engaging customers, MAU, DAUs, etc. If you are a SaaS kind of a business or an enterprise business, you would be at a certain ARR or MRR, right? So ultimately your funding is allowing you to move from point A to point B in terms of the business metrics and the product roadmap. You start your conversations, obviously not all investors operate at all stages. For example, Bloom is an early stage investor. It doesn't price Series A or Series B risk typically, right? Other investors might have similar, you know, stage preferences. So you would zone into that. Some founders might have a preference to go with, for example, vertical focused funds or vertical focused investors, because possibly they can add a lot of value. For example, there are funds operating around, you know, which only invest in fintech, only in consumer, etc., etc. All of that could happen. So you have a target set of fundraise. You have a target for a fundraise. What are you raising? How much are you raising and for what? You have a target set of investors. You start those interactions. Right? The investor, typically diligence gets deeper as you grow. Right? But investor would want to diligence, would send you a term sheet. They would have their own process. They would have their own preferences. It might be so that at a certain point in time an investor has already invested into a competitor. They might not want to fund another in that space. It could be that they are not looking at a certain vertical at a certain point in time. All those things could happen, but that is that you get to know only when you start engaging, right? These things are not apparent. Obviously you get to a term sheet. If there is an agreement, a term sheet, as I said, is again a package, and you need to, you know, understand the package in totality. What is the kind of, and again, right, you need to decide what kind of dilution are you willing to suffer for, what kind of capital, or rather what quantum of capital. And similarly, the investor takes a call on whether they like the idea, what are their preferences around the stage, how do they see the market, and what is the target stage or the target valuation that they're willing to give? And again, incidentally, I mean, lots of you pointed about excesses in the ecosystem. All those excesses that we saw, let us say, 2 years back, have now gone away, right? There used to be a lot of FOMO and we saw unrealistic valuations. All of that is not there today. It could come back tomorrow. You don't know, but that happens in all markets. It is not something which is specific or endemic to, you know, the venture ecosystem. Happens all the time in public markets also. Too few capital chasing, too few good assets, etc. So coming back to the fundraise process, a term sheet is issued. You need to understand it, respond to it. Documentation and detailed diligence starts. And diligence, again, at early stage, that diligence is not about, you know, your bookkeeping or your what you call your compliances. It is, of course, a lot of focus is on those elements as well, because they are basics of the governance. Beyond that, diligence is also about, for example, your deck says an ARR of $10 million or $1 million. Are those numbers truly backed up? Right? Your deck mentions a certain state of technology. Is the technology that you are using for the product actually at that stage? It would be multidimensional across all elements. It would also involve, for example, customer references, etc., customer conversations, external expert references, all of that. So it's an involved process for the investor. And of course, the company has to support in whatever ways. So again, very important that the founder has to be ready for this kind of a journey in terms of a fundraise, because it could be quite involving. It's a simple process, but it needs time, attention, and bandwidth in that sense. After all of this is done, you would find the legal documents to be discussed and negotiated. Again, I mean, negotiation would be around various things, various terms such as tag, drag, the founder vesting, the kind of ESOP pool that needs to be created at that point in time, right? All of that. And that is how you close the process. And again, like anything is, till such time a thing is closed, it is not closed. So that closing, which itself involves, in a country like India, which is slightly more heavy on the compliance, heavy as in sense of, I would say, long processes. You need to have those processes right. For example, you need to have a separate bank account, right? You need to file certain returns. All of that needs to be done before you can see that money in your bank account. So it is about like following through, being on the ball all the time, being transparent and honest with the investors. And at the same time, being able to convey your story in the best possible manner. And again, throughout this process, across the levels, right, be it, let us say, a partner at the firm or the, you know, the VP who is taking your or leading the deal, to the deal team, to the execution team, you have to build trust across all levels, which is very important, because these are the investors who would also possibly support you next time around, or at least would need to, or at least they would need to signal that they are ready to support you in the next round. And obviously, like, investors are partners in the growth journey. So need to build that trust, that relationship, which would last, that period of time.
So let's do some philosophy now. In the sense that, so when diligence fails, or in the sense that when diligence is compromised, or the VC firm does not do proper diligence, let's say, due to various reasons, either because they were not diligent enough, or they were not rigorous enough, or maybe the company was not transparent enough. Either ways, when that happens, do you think it's mostly greed taking over? Like, earlier you mentioned, I think 2 years back, there was this FOMO. I mean, there was this environment of like not missing out, wanting to not miss out on any deals. So you think it's just greed taking over, or is it just, that desire to make quick returns, you perceive that if you close this deal, even if the diligence is not like very rigorous, you have the chance to make outsized returns. So what do you think that is? If any thoughts on that?
No, again, failure of a diligence is would definitely be a red flag. And of course, there are situations, right? For example, the founders started the company. Let us take one hypothetical example. Two founders coming from a tech background, starting a company, scaling the product, now taking on some funding externally, right? Now some and relying upon some external advisors, etc., to do their Companies Act filing, or let us say income tax filing or GST filings. And there were some gaps there which were discovered during the diligence. Now these are not red flags as in the founder's integrity or transparency. These are red flags which are solvable, and these are more about the capacity that needs to be created for the business to operate as a business, right? Not as merely as a, you know, as an idea factory or a project. So very, very, I would say that failing a diligence at, you know, with these kind of things, which could be more operational in nature, could happen, and for no one's fault, right? There would be, if there are red flags around, I would say, integrity or transparency or governance, I don't think there are any investor, even in a FOMO market, would be wanting to be involved with these kind of businesses. That doesn't happen usually. At least we haven't seen it happen, right? Because the malice then would be much, much deeper. And I don't think that happens, to be very honest, that I don't think that happens a lot. Because ultimately, founders are creating value for themselves, in which investors would only be a part of. Typically, investors, early stage investors like us, or even, you know, later stage investors, would be a certain percentage. Rest of the business belongs to the founders, the teams, etc., etc. Right? So why would someone want to do this for, let us say, 20 or 30% owners of the business, when they are owning the rest? So I don't think that's a normal situation to be in. And if it is, I don't think FOMO or no FOMO, there will be any, you know, any progress on these kind of transactions. Usually doesn't happen. It has happened, like, in talking for Bloom, right? In our 12 years of journey, it has happened once. And this was like way back. So that is, I don't think this is a normal situation to be. Of course, there could be outliers, but not very often.
Understood. I'm curious about the cost. Like, is it very expensive to get this? Not only diligence done, but this whole process. Maybe is it expensive, or is it just like, I don't know?
So process expensive in terms of founders' time. Yes, they have to be involved, right? It might be a simple process, but for accomplished founders or second-time founders, but obviously a fundraise would be a major project, which has a potential of, you know, adding more burden on the daily workload, right? It's a very important project, and business won't stop, right? So that keeps on happening in parallel. You need to, in terms of cost, etc., I don't think so. It is very expensive. And of course, like cost of the diligence, cost of the transaction is paid for by the company, but out of the funding that you receive. Right? So, okay. So there is a cost in terms of dilution, if you were to, but that is par for course, and that is a fairly, fairly accepted practice. That this cost will not be more than 5 to 7% of the raise.
That's a non-significant amount, right? 5 to 7%.
No, but this is a cost which is consistent. Even if you were to do an IPO of a decent size, right? It will be a similar 7 to 8% kind of a cost is what you would need to defray.
And this goes mostly to the lawyers, right? Or am I missing something?
Lawyers, due diligence agencies, mostly. These are the two most important. But again, this cost also has some benefits, because, for example, when you are coming across a diligence, right, it prepares you, or rather it helps you find things that you did not or could not. So, for example, lots of the process gaps at high level, or I said, for example, I pointed out compliance gaps, or at least some insights on how a external agency sees you. All of which is important from the next fundraise point of view as well. Right? Because typically you would want to fix all of this before you go out in the market again. If not at that point in time. Because either these would be a part of your conditions precedent, so these will be fixed right away, or these will be a part of your conditions subsequent, and investors will expect you to fix these within a certain period of time, typically 6 months or so. Once you have more bandwidth, once you have more resources, right? Or so the company gets cleaned up in that sense. There's a lot of work which happens around this. So this cost pays for itself. That is how I would say.
Again, a vague question, which is, are there any parameters of money which might be allocated during a seed, series A, series B, series C? So what I'm trying to understand is like, when I'm thinking of like seed, I generally think of, let's say, $500,000, $100,000, $500,000, $1 million maybe. When I'm thinking of series A, I'm thinking like $3 to $5 million. Series B, I have no idea. Series C, I have no idea. So is there something like that where people have like this benchmark that, okay, this is seed, I'm willing to allocate X, and this is series A, or is it very vague?
So again, these are terms and these vary, right? So for example, in 2016, 2017, seed rounds used to be $1 million. Now a seed round is $4 to $5 million. So this could be, there could be seed rounds which are $2 million. Again, it's a function of what the business needs to go from point A to point B, and how much the founders are willing to dilute, and what is the stake that the investors expect for putting in a certain amount of capital. So some investors would have a certain stake target. They would not, for example, want to come in below a decent double-digit stake, right? Because it is not worth their time, or that is their starting point. They can't go below that. Similarly, founders, let us say at seed, would not want to dilute, let's say 30-35%. You have to find that balance. So typically, I would say the seed rounds, typically what we are seeing currently, and we are actively investing, 4 to 5 millions. Now you would have read in the media there have been seed rounds or initial rounds which were $30 million, but obviously for a very different kind of founders, and they were like two or three rounds rolled into one, right? A series A again would be, I would say, $10 million kind of. But these milestones are better understood in terms of the traction, where you are receiving a traction, or rather the stage of the business, rather than a absolute number. Again, there will be broad ranges. A series B would be, for example, somewhere between $25 to $50 million, more towards the, you know, the upper end, because you would expect at each stage the valuation to grow 2 to 4x with the same level of dilution. Let us say 15 to 20% to 25%, which means that these numbers will grow in that proportion, right? 4 to 5 to 10 to 50. That is how I would peg, but there is no hard and fast about it.
I understand that there is no hard and fast about this, but in the sense that, is it a general expectation that every successive round your valuation should ideally double or quadruple? Is that a general expectation, or
if the company is doing well, hitting its numbers, what it had promised. Right? That is how I would think about raising. Because otherwise, right, what are you growing into? And at each stage, your requirements of capital are aligned to the stage of the business. See, again, any founder in their right minds are raising capital to support a particular stage of growth. Of course, you should be able to raise as much as possible at a certain point in time. Because, you know, there are lots of uncertainties which you don't want to be hit with. For example, no one anticipated this kind of a downturn. The funding winter, as they say, although there are sufficient number of companies which have got new rounds of funding led by new investors, even in this kind of environment, all of that is fine. But at the same time, you are ultimately raising funds for a business requirement. You have a certain plan to scale in at a certain level, to hit a certain metric. And that plan is supported by a certain need of capital, what the kind of team that you need, the kind of spend that you need to, you know, scale up your tech, the kind of spend that you need to build a certain kind of marketing ops in a particular geography or expand geographically. All of that has to grow into that funding number. It has to be a bottoms up. It can't be a top down, okay, I got $5 million. Now let me think about what do I build from it.
In terms of the, just to push this, I think I've heard, Max, I've heard is, I think, Series F, I think on the news. Is there a provision, like, I mean, is there a standard that, you know, there is Series A, B, C, D, E, F? Or does it stop at F or and then it's the IPO? Like, is there something like that or is it very informal?
Honestly, it doesn't. Again, see, this nomenclature is not scientific, right? Stage of the company, yes, you can make out, okay, I mean, let us say companies such as, I would say, an academy are at a certain stage, right? And a company such as, let's say, Zomato is at a certain stage. That is all that is. And everyone operates within these broad bands or broad ranges, right? There is no scientific, or rather no legal or scientific way of defining a series. So for example, we look at documents, right? Because we are a fairly active investors, and some companies call their first round a Series A, the very first time they are raising capital. Others call it Series Seed. So nomenclatures are fungible, but at the same time, the stage at your business is the kind of IRR or ARR or the metrics that you are hitting, the kind of revenue that you are making, that determines, you know, revenue or whatever other metric that you're using, that actually determines the stage of the business. You could have, I mean, even at a growth stage, a company could have multiple rounds of funding because capital was available and they found it prudent to take that capital and grow, let us say, inorganically to make an acquisition. There could be so many elements.
I was thinking about...
To answer your question, I have seen companies like Till Series I, J, etc.
So, okay. Like, I was thinking about like SpaceX. Like, SpaceX has been private for, I think, over 20 years now. They must have raised so many times. So I was like a little confused. Like, does it stop at F or like what are they doing? Yeah.
No, that's a very interesting point, because more and more we have seen... So let us say if SpaceX was built in, let's say, 20, in the year, let's say, 2005, possibly it would have gone towards an IPO because it was a very different market. The trend that we are seeing, we have been seeing, not we, everyone has been seeing, is more and more companies are staying private because there is private capital available and there are investors who have appetite to enter at growth stage and stay invested into the company. So no need to, you know, seek public market money. You could stay private and keep on building because you have investors who understand that business. Sophisticated investors, typically the level of sophistication that you would find in a public market, right? Because public markets are very, very much oriented towards data, analytics, right? Profitability, the path to profitability, all of that. You have that sophistication now come in private assets as well. And there is a certain stage creep because, again, if you were to talk about portfolio construction, people want to have high growth private assets in the portfolio, which means that asset managers, funds, etc., would find such opportunities for their clients. So that is happening a lot.
Just to make sure I understood that, they're okay to be invested for a decade or two and not see any returns, is it? Is that fair to say?
No, not that way. At each stage, the company will attract new investors. The older investors could choose to stay invested or find exits through the new investors. There could be a combination of primary and secondary in a particular round. But investors, the point here is investors have appetite And of course, the longevity as well, in some cases, who be invested in private assets.
Understood. Okay. My knowledge in this, how they make money or how they is very limited. So as you can see, yeah.
No, but money ultimately has to be made by exiting. And at some point, I mean, assets have to turn profitable. So that is the only way, right? You make money. There is no other way.
So till now I was like confused. Like I thought do they have so much appetite that, you know, they are willing to put their money in like for a decade or more. You cleared it up for me. Yeah. I'm curious about, is there something to be said about working with other investors? Like, I think generally there is a venture firm that takes a lead maybe in a round, and then there might be multiple investors as well. Plus, I think you may be carrying some burden, or you'll be carrying forward your other investors, maybe your angels or your friends and family as well. So anything to be said for that, in the sense, maybe how to accommodate such people, or how to what is the kind of dynamic that takes place? Any thoughts on that? Like, how should we think about that?
Yeah, sure. At each stage, the roles and I would say responsibilities of the investors would keep on evolving, right? So once you have a growth stage investor, for example, come in, they would obviously have board seats. If the early investor, let us say a Bloom, is participating in the round or has shareholding above a certain threshold, which is determined at the time of the round, they would continue to be on the board. But the new investor who is leading the round in terms of setting the price, right, and has certain expectations from the company, would possibly join the board in all, or rather they would join the board, right? They would start owning some of the board decisions. Not that investors make board decisions, but they need to be on board. They would have their own requirements or expectations which would get added to whatever was happening earlier, right? In terms of legal rights, obviously at each point, rights get reset. So for example, the investors coming in at a later point in time, talking about the normal round, they would have a liquidation, they could have a liquidation preference, they could have other rights, etc., which could be or may not be superior to the early investors. Same happens at seed stage, same would happen at Series A, but ultimately, right, someone has to be able to work with the founders and the company and see and steer it, right? And obviously, if someone is doing it, other investors would possibly take a back seat, because ultimately, if someone is working for their 20% stake, they're also taking care of the other 80%. You can't do these things in isolation. No one has these kind of rights that they will be able to. We are not talking about LBOs where, you know, a private equity comes in and, you know, takes out money from the company or ensures cash flow from the company, which is a very accepted model globally. So ultimately, point is that investors have to work together, but someone would take a lead, or rather be in a position of a lead at a certain point in time. Again, different investors could have different, you know, approaches or different capabilities to help. And the founder, good founders would typically leverage all the help that they need from their board and their cap table, right? So it is not that the value or importance of any investor in absolute term varies. It is what is right for the business at a particular point in time. For example, Bloom has a very clear approach about adding a lot of value through our platform initiatives, which focus around, let us say, fundraise for the company, corporate development, hiring, advisory services around transactions, ESOPs, legal, compliance, etc., and also the community effort that we do, right? So our community team ensures that there is a lot of engagement, which is growing, which keeps on growing within the portfolio and with the broader ecosystem. So if founders choose, even if they are a growth stage, they would leverage these initiatives that we have an offer for our portfolio companies. Similarly, other firms could bring in other sources or other ways of adding value which would work for the company at a certain point in time. Angel investors could add a lot of value. Your early investors, since they have seen the business, they could have their own network. So you don't know how these, what becomes relevant there. There's no science behind it. But again, it's a human dynamic which keeps on, you know, evolving.
Should we discuss valuation a little bit? Like, I mean, how should founders maybe approach valuation? Do people pay too much attention to valuation, too less attention? I think one big issue, I don't know, I feel is like people overvalue maybe their businesses, and that might be an issue, or maybe some people undervalue, I don't know. So any thoughts on like how to approach valuation? How do you think about it?
Right. So valuation, as I said earlier, is a function of three things. The capital needed to reach from point A to point B. The kind of dilution that the founders are willing to take at that point in time, and the investor stake target. This is at the early stage because there is no science to the valuation at any stage for that matter. But increasingly, as you grow, valuation keeps on getting, you know, tied to your performance and to clear milestone. Example, a multiple of GMV or any other metric. Now, and also it would factor the competition, the, you know, the state of the market, the global comparables, etc. Now, very good point that you made is around the overvaluation or undervaluation. Because by undervaluing a company, you are hurting your own chances of success because you would have that much less capital, right? Which means that much less runway for growth. So even by protecting dilution, right, that doesn't help. Overvaluation is a big problem because ultimately at every stage or every subsequent stage, the company would be expected to grow into the valuation that they are seeking. So a company which raised capital at a valuation of $1 billion in 2019, promising a certain set of numbers, would need to reach in vicinity of those numbers which are promised, which were baked into the $1 billion valuation, for it to be able to raise more capital at a higher valuation, or at least for that valuation to be held sacrosanct. If you're not growing, so ultimately every business has to grow into the valuation. So by, you know, targeting valuations artificially, you are not helping, because at some point in time, there would be a correction if the numbers are not supporting. If you have overperformed, obviously you would get compensated in the future rounds. You dilute that much less because you'll be able to command a better valuation. But the reverse would always be true as well, right? So, and also valuation, as I was alluding to earlier, you can't be, you know, blind towards the terms. You also have to see valuation as a package of terms that at which the valuation is being offered, right? Which could have, for example, the kind of founder vesting, what kind of ESOP pool that is required to be created. All of those also come into play. So you need to be cognizant of that, because ultimately the outcomes, or rather exit outcomes, are not only a function of the valuation, they're also a function of these legal terms. For example, of investor, I mean, doesn't happen in real world, investor coming with a 4x liquidation preference, which means that they would get 4x their capital before everyone else gets paid, before the founders, you know, make a single penny. That is the cost of overvaluing the company if the business doesn't perform.
So in that sense, like the correction maybe that happened, like I think I was looking at like Stripe's valuation, which was I think 95 pre-COVID, and I think recently they had to raise at a corrected valuation at 65 billion, I think. So, and I think that is one example, but I think multiple examples where I think a correction has happened post-COVID, or the post-COVID mania. So those situations are generally quote-unquote bad, is it? I mean, it's not generally a good sign where your startup is valued less than your earlier round. Is that fair? Or
see, there could be two situations when this happens. One is when there is a market correction. Investors typically, even investors in private assets, would have some correlation with public markets or publicly listed assets at which they would value private assets. So obviously, if there is a broader market correction, you would not get that valuation that you would have got in a normal scenario, which honestly is not something anyone can help, because you can't time these things beyond a point. What is important is that you have capital, which gives you runway to keep on growing the business in the right direction. And at some point, the business would be valued fairly. Right? Because obviously you can't take out markets from the valuation equation. So that is there. The other scenario is that there is nothing wrong with the market, but the story was oversold, right? And the business failed to perform and grow into that valuation, which is the larger problem, or which is the problem actually, right? Because in the other case, the company will continue its growth momentum, even if there is a higher dilution that everyone on the cap table will need to suffer. Right? The existing investors would suffer, the ESOP holders, the founders, everyone would need to take in, but the business would keep on growing. And that's a tactical call that many companies take, and there is nothing wrong with it. Right? The bigger problem is that valuation was inflated. It was a function of an overheated market. The business did not perform, did not reach that stage. And now that's a problem, because you have to take a down round just to survive. And worse still, there will be no capital available. Right? Because founders' expectations, and it is not only the founders, right? The investors would also have their views when a round is happening. The existing set of investors, they have to be on board with you. So then it could become very challenging to be able to sustain the business momentum if you are not willing to, you know, take that correction in your stride. And if the market and the business was not fundamentally sound enough, that you would, you know, take a correction and keep on operating at a solid scale. I think that's the larger problem.
What do you think is the role of negotiation? Like, I mean, like, do these things happen like very... one example I can think of is like Shark Tank, right? Like, I mean, I don't know if you watch Shark Tank, but like Shark Tank, I think negotiation is a key aspect, right? Like, I mean, so they will shoot a number. I'm so sorry, there's a plane passing by. I don't know if you can hear it.
Yeah, I could faint, but yes. You are based out of Bangalore?
I'm based out of Bangalore, actually. So about, there are so many times there are a lot of planes passing by. So that's a huge headache. Anyways, so what I was saying was, how important is like the aspect of negotiation? So one example is obviously, I can think of a Shark Tank. So Shark Tank in general, the negotiation happens around like at what percent stake they will take for what amount of cash. And generally there's a back and forth that happens. I feel like if you can negotiate well, then obviously it feels like a good skill to have. Is it fair, like, or in the sense that in the real world, or when people are discussing behind closed doors, is negotiation still a very good skill to have? Or is there a lot of negotiation that happens? Or is it generally numbers get thrown and, you know, quickly everything gets decided?
No, negotiations do happen, right? And again, but negotiation is not as dramatic, right? Because one aspect of negotiation is the absolute number, which is the valuation that is ascribed to the company, right? The other aspect would always be the dilution. And it's a very personal thing, right? Some people want to negotiate hard. They don't want to lead, or rather yield any inch. It could be on either of the sides. It could even be the lawyers or the, you know, advisors who are engaged. So it's a very personal approach to negotiation. Right? Some people possibly would have a very balanced view where they would know what they want and they're willing to give the other party what the other party needs, and the two in many cases don't overlap. So it's a win-win. So negotiations, not necessarily a bad thing, right? At the same time, they are not as glamorous. It's a protracted process that we have seen, right? So things, unglamorous things like founder vesting, that founder's stock would need to, even if they're holding, let us say 50%, it would vest over a period of 4 years to them, and they can't exit, effectively a lock-in over a period of time. Those kind of things would get negotiated. How much can founders sell, right? What are the rights that an investor needs in terms of the decision-making for the business? I think those are, of course, valuation is very important, but negotiation is much more wider than merely the valuation number that we see getting negotiated on a Shark Tank. The real negotiations are around, you know, those kind of things. Because, and also, it is also about, for example, investors might take a call that they want to work with a certain kind of founder in a certain, you know, sector, which would lead them to take a particular stance. Similarly, a founder might see a lot of value or might find a lot of comfort in working with a certain set of investors. So there is no hard and fast, or there is no, you know, set rules that you need to negotiate. I think, you know, wealth is getting created if a business is successful, and that wealth is for everyone. So it is not asymmetrical. It's not, you know, one or zero. So negotiation, not necessarily a bad thing, but at the same time, I don't think we have seen anyone over negotiate or be without good reasons. Of course, the negotiation that a first-time founders would have would be very different from a, let us say, a returning founder or an exited founder, right? Negotiation could also be, for example, on the kind of ESOP pool that investors expect the company to create, because that's a dilution for the existing set of investors, not for the incoming investors. So it could take different forms and shape. But again, these need not be a 0-1 kind of a situation.
Have you watched Shark Tank?
Sometimes. Not very regular. We have enough drama in our lives without Shark Tank.
What do you think of Shark Tank?
Interesting. And, you know, the... So for me, right, the... So actually... To relate an anecdote, so my father, who was a professor, right, a scientist, and he was Shark Tank, I did not, and he asked me whether, I mean, this is how Bloom operates. So for an old, you know, person who is not connected with the work of startups, to him to be able to see in whatever ways, right, might not be the closest, I would say, example. But at the same time, for him to be able to see how startups operate, how startups raise funds, etc., was a very different experience. And so what they have done is they have created a lot of awareness and education around the startup and created an excitement around the startup ecosystem in India, which is very important. For me, that was a very, like, fascinating aspect, that a TV show can, you know, have such a role in creating so much mind space, right, and awareness about something which people of at least of a certain, I would say, age group or a certain segment, housewives, for example, did not bother about.
So going back to funding, once we have the money in the bank, let's assume that, you know, all the process is done. We have the, you know, we requested $100 billion. $100 billion are in the bank. So, what metrics? What kind of milestones or metrics do you think founders should track? And also the relationship after the funding, right? What not only what should the founders track, but also what the VCs do you think encourage the founders to track, and you know, how much do they like, is it like, do they have like a monthly call where they try to analyze the business and you know where it's going, how it's going, and you know, could you speak to that?
Yeah, definitely. So for founders, what is very important, obviously funds are being raised for a certain purpose, and that plan is already discussed broadly. No investor would want to get into, you know, the feet of the founder and start meddling into execution. But broadly, the founder is very clear at that point in time that what kind of people now since they have the, you know, cash sitting in the bank, they would want to onboard. What kind of efforts on marketing, what channels they would want to deploy, right? What kind of infrastructure they would want to build for the team, for example. Right? What kind of experiments they would want to run, if at all. Maybe on the tech side, on ops side, what kind of ops capability they would want to build. So essentially, all of that is already discussed in some ways or the other, broadly. Right? Now, once that funding is in place, the founders would do well to start executing and implementing, take help as needed, bring external advisors on board, for example, to get good hires, right? Buy whatever tech or other resources, production resources that they need, build that ops capability, all of that. What is very important at this stage is to start communicating or build a cadence of communicating the successes, the roadmap, and the failures, the challenges to your investor set. That should actually happen at all points in time, but becomes equally or rather more important once you have external capital in the company, so that your investors are on board, they are aware of the challenges, of the wins, right, of the path and the progress that the company is making, and they are able to contribute. One good practice that we have seen is by way of an email which goes out, let us say, every quarter or every month or whatever frequency, founders asking for help, that we need help with this kind of a hire, or we need help with connects in this particular area, or we need help to reach out to these kind of customers, right? And obviously, if investors can, they would definitely try and get that help in, or at least have a discussion around having that, those aspects sorted out. As far as investors go, as I said, their role is to help and assist. We believe that our responsibility towards our founders is to be available to them as and when they need, and have periodic catch-ups to understand their issues, to understand what direction the company is taking, to keep them grounded and realistic towards the direction the business needs to take, right? And also keep them on the path of growth. So that conversation, of course, some companies prefer doing it by a formal board call. Some founders have a different style where they would want to do this more informally. Some people use a combination of both, that apart from a board call, there could be one-on-one catch-ups as and when they need to be able to sound out, discuss. And also, your investors can also fill in a lot of, I would say, resource issues when you are still early and don't have a large team. So they can help in various ways. For example, helping you interview key resources. You're onboarding a CXO, right? You would want an external validation or a view. You're not very sure of yourself. You should definitely reach out to your investors and ask them if they can, you know, do a round of interviews for you. Help can come in different forms, whichever ways the founders, you know, deem best for their businesses. But it's an ongoing process, and that is the kind of cadence that should be put. And that is the kind of relationship, more importantly, that should be built between the founders and the investors, apart from the governance or the compliance or the formal board process that needs to be run. But there has to be some element of that as well, because you need to, you know, start into that cadence.
What happens if the if between rounds people run out of financing? Is the company, is it just like the, is the company dead, or is something can be done there?
No, definitely. So again, which is where the communication becomes very important. If the company is running out of of capital, it has a very limited runway. Investors would want to know and be in the know, let us say 4 months ahead of the, I would say, day zero, instead of this coming, you know, as a call that, okay, today I've run out of cash. How do I, you know, meet my payroll for the next week, for the next month? So typically, I mean, in the first situation, there would be a path you can, for example, there could be a bridge round which your investors could support you with. If they have conviction in the business and they know that there are outlier events which led to a company running out of cash. No one wants surprises, especially like bad surprises like these. But at the same time, bridge rounds are fairly common. And these are structured, these can be structured very cleverly. Typically, these are internal rounds. Your internal investors need to have some sort of confidence or need to put out a vote of confidence. You could even onboard external investors. Maybe they would not want to price the round. This could take form of a convert or a safe round, which is then priced at the whenever the subsequent round happens, or at a event which is prior. So that is the only option that you have. Bridge, typically your internals would need to bridge you for that gap. But you start working on the plan to raise the proper round, maybe recalibrate the growth, show a path towards rationalization of costs if that is a challenge. Because we have seen, like, due to overexcitement, etc., teams getting bloated or cost bases getting bloated. All of that needs to be recalibrated so that growth is not compromised. And then you go for a subsequent round if you are able to sustain the business at that point in time.
Any common mistakes or any stupid mistakes that you've seen people make repeatedly during this process, this whole process?
See, again, the worst mistake that you can make is not have your investors on board your progress and your path. At the same time, you would never want to close any conversations. You should take capital as it becomes available, right? So that you don't have to, keep on searching for capital when you need it. So a company, and any company which is accelerating the burn without having alternatives in mind would be in a problem. That should be definitely avoided. You should have a very clear view. And as investors, one of the responsibilities towards the business, towards all the stakeholders, including the founders, is to insist upon a certain visibility into the AOP or the operating plan. What kind of burn the business is suffering, and how are they thinking about the burn? Right? Are they confident? Have they already initiated, let us say, fundraise conversations? Or they have a venture debt line which they will be able to tap in, right? That kind of visibility is important for the investors, and they have a role here to be able to insist the company follow and develop this kind of a system so that there are no blind spots. Because once you are operating at a certain scale, bandwidth constraints, team constraints would always remain at all stages. You need to have some system and process which would throw up these kind of red flags so that no one is blindsided and you can, course correct at the right point in time.
Understood. Is there anything I have forgotten to bring up, Alok, that you would like to touch on?
Here again, an important, I mean, of course, you have asked everything, Rehan, so that is there. Now, one thing also is around the challenges that the founders face, which you had alluded to earlier, right? So very, very, so my colleague Sajid uses a term called founder investor fit. So founders, right? So for investor, founders need to be very clear what kind of investors they want to work with. And there is a lot of, I would say, chemistry that goes behind this. At the same time, founders would be expected to solve for certain things. And no one else can do it. As I said, access to investors, they have to find connects, they have to find the right sources of funding. That is what we were speaking about earlier. They are responsible for clearly articulating the story, the growth prospects, and the clear sense of the business metrics that the business would be able to deliver, or the product that the business will be able to deliver, right? Which includes a clear thought process on how they plan to scale. Not only the business, but how do they plan to scale themselves in terms of the bandwidth and the capacity. Very clearly articulate the kind of teams that they would want to build, which would run the business at a certain point in time. And most successful founders are always very self-aware and coachable. They know, they are aware of the gaps, or they are willing to listen when someone is highlighting the kind of gaps that they see in the business and willing to work towards it, either by ramping up their own capabilities or bringing other people on board. Again, they have, in terms of the fundraise, they have to have a clear understanding of the process and be patient with it. They have to be able to navigate and negotiate the process. Many a time it will boil down to, you know, taking the right calls. To that extent, disintermediate, because ultimately you are responsible for deciding what is good for you or what is bad for you. An advisor can only point you in the right direction. So take those calls and create bandwidth to do all of this. So as I think far you can as also, yeah, please.
No, I mean, I think you can also avoid situations like I've heard some stories where founders didn't want to sell the company or didn't want to merge the company with somebody else, but investors kind of forced their hand. So I think you can avoid these situations as well, no? If the, what you mentioned about founder-investor fit, is that fair or?
No, it is not. See, again, as an investor, right? The role of an investor is to do the right things for the business. It is not to do the right thing for the founder or for themselves. Because ultimately, if there is business is what is a shared responsibility and a shared ownership. Right? So ultimately, everyone, all stakeholders, all shareholders on the cap table, all the board members need to decide on what is the right path for the business. There have been, and also to add to what you are saying, there have been n number of stories where founders were not able to scale once the business reached a certain stage. This is the famous story of Steve Jobs, whom the board felt is not able to scale and they thought of replacing him. Not the best of calls, but right? So those kind of conversations also need to happen, and it is a responsibility for the investors to act in best interest of everyone. Right? If the founder is not able to scale into a growth stage CEO, maybe he was a great early stage CEO, right? Building the business from zero to one. Maybe not the right person to take the business from 1 to 10 or 10 to 100. He should be willing to step aside and bring in a professional CEO or build a team under him or do whatever it takes. So it is those kind of decisions. M&A, if the company is doing well, I don't think any those kind of discussions ever happen. These are more of distress situations where all options are on the table, right? And the stakeholders have to decide which path do they need to take, which is the least painful path. No, again, two small points. One is obviously, and this is something that we spoke as well, or rather touched upon as well, is about right sizing the rounds. How do you raise the right kind of right, and how do you right size around? Because obviously, as I said, there is a, you know, percentage holding expectation on either sides, dilution as well as incoming investors. how do you, especially as you keep on growing, how do you tactically use, for example, secondaries to minimize your dilution? Or you use venture debt to extend your runway without diluting too much at a certain point in time. Let us say you are tracking a particular matrix at, let's say, 10x. And you know for a fact that if you were to continue, you'll hit 15x, which will give you a very different scale of valuation. Now, to enable you to move from the 10x to 15x number, would you are you able to create some runway either by bringing in, for example, capital by way of convertible notes through some friendly investors, or maybe structure the round in a way that you take some money ahead as a convert, hit that milestone, and then take the money at the new valuation? These are all structures that one should be open about and use tactically. And there is a lot of, you know, again, it's a very, very vast topic and how these can be done, right? But again, this should be kept in mind because there are no linear functions here. So that is something which has to be there. Also, typically what we have seen and what we have supported as well is, coming to the dilution point, founders should not be overly concerned about the dilution. Because if the business is doing well, your investors will be more than happy to re-up the MSOPs or management stock options, so that your stake is, you know, protected to a certain extent. So those kind of options are also possible, only if for the right reasons. So if the founders are able to scale and grow the business, are able to demonstrate, right, their value and their efforts, all of these options are on the table. So one should not be overly worried about dilution, because there are ways to ratchet it back, and founders, rather investors, will be supportive of it. That has been our experience.
I think dilution is something that gets talked about a lot, and I think general sentiment is that you should not dilute much, and like people get very scared of diluting too much equity. So, okay. But you're saying that that shouldn't be such a huge factor.
No, ultimately, if the business is doing well, you will be able to drive value, right? And your investors who are backing you would be able to, you know, take care of at least a major part of the concern around dilution, if not the entire dilution. So one should never over optimize on valuations, because then you would end up either raising too much capital or too little. Either scenario.
I think I have the Elon example here again, which is, I think, because he took the company from $100 billion valuation to like a $1 trillion valuation, I think he was awarded a lot of stock options, to which people took him to court as well. And there was a lawsuit filed as well. But I think that also talks to about, I think that is also kind of the argument that you're making, right? I mean, because of his performance, I think he was given sort of options, partly due to which he became the world's richest man as well. Understood. Okay. Anything else? I want to make sure that we've covered everything. Is there any other point that you'd like to make, or...
No, one last point is that when I should have brought it up when we were talking about negotiating. Now, one should be able to negotiate shareholder rights in a manner that these don't impede your business. It should not happen that a shareholder who is holding 1% is able to block something, some corporate action in the company, which is beneficial, or rather which is beneficial 100%, but 99% of the investors are in favor. And just due to a technicality, you have left and, you know, that option open for a shareholder with a 1% kind of a right. It doesn't mean that you would, you know, ride roughshod over minority. That is not what I'm trying to say here. Just that this should be done in a fair and very pragmatic manner, so that your processes, etc. Let us say a fundraise is not held up just because some investor is not in favor. Or let us say not, that's the extreme scenario that usually doesn't happen. let's say some investor is traveling abroad, you need his signatures, and you're not able to contact him. Then you need to close the round, let's say in 2 days. Right? So that is something which should be a part of the overall negotiation and round construct. That you need to be very aware of the pitfalls or the roadblocks that could happen at each stage and keep on working to ease them out.
So this knowledge, I think, has to be there when you're making these contacts itself, right? Like, I mean, this has to be like kind of factored in.
That is right. Your advisors should be able to, you know, guide you towards this. But the founders, obviously, like the buck stops at them. They should also be aware of what they're getting into.
Part of this is also like a knowledge game, right? You should be aware of all these things. Like, if you're not aware, then sometimes you'll just be like, even though you may have options, if you're not aware that you have options, you'll be just like, you won't be able to take actions which maximize your probability of success or, you know, yeah, doing good things.
This is very true. And this is what I was saying, that being a founder is a 24/7 job. Because if you're not working, you need to keep on working to, you know these kind of things. Keep on talking to people who make you aware and guide you.